Before Rosh Hashanah, my father would make the trip from our home in New Jersey to the cemetery in Brooklyn where his father and grandparents were buried. He never asked my mother or me to accompany him on this journey. I can see him now. He parks his car near the small utility building just inside the gates, then walks along the narrow paths of the vast graveyard, thousands upon thousands of headstones etched in Hebrew, spread out in every direction, until he arrives at the Shapiro family plot. In the distance, the rumble of an elevated train and the white noise of traffic on the Belt Parkway. A wild dog barks. He unlatches the heavy chain that cordons the family plot off from the path. Perhaps he sits on a bench for a few moments and thinks of his father. He recites the mourner's Kaddish at the foot of his father's grave. Yitkadal v'yikadash Shmei Rabbah. He pokes around the roots and pebbles, the fallen leaves, until he finds just the right handful of stones. He places one atop each of his ancestors' graves, a custom that symbolizes permanence. Does my father foresee his own early death only a decade away? He can't envision the future, his daughter making her way alone down the cemetery's narrow paths year after year, reciting the mourner's Kaddish for him, warming a stone in her hands. The dates Ben proposed in early October most likely fell within Elul. Before I had a chance to even glance at my calendar, Michael had finished gassing up the car and climbed back into the driver's seat. I wordlessly handed him my phone. Ben Walden. The feeling, the predominant one, was of being flooded with relief. See, I wasn't wrong about him. A hard knot inside me unraveled. I had the strangest sense that I knew him, though I had never spent a moment in his presence. His last letter to me had seemed harsh, perhaps influenced by others, and didn't feel expressive of his true self. But how could I possibly know anything about Ben Walden's true self? Did the genetic code that linked us allow me to recognize him? Was there a gene for depth of thought? For kindness? It may well be the right thing for both of us. Not just for me, for him as well. Sense of reality to our human connection. In the weeks of silence between us, I had become real to him. Apologize for wavering. Hope that you are still interested. I told you something would happen, Michael said. He reached over and squeezed my hand. Yeah, but this. I stared at the screen. Lunch, New Jersey, October. I studied Ben's email as if it were a cryptogram. I noticed that he misspelled the word thoughts in the subject line. Second thought us. As Michael pulled back onto the highway, I opened the calendar on my phone and looked up the two dates Ben had proposed. They didn't fall over Elul. They fell on Erev Yom Kippur and Yom Kippur, the two holiest days of the year. Dear Ben, I would be happy to meet you and Pilar on Tuesday, October 11th, near Paramus. I'm glad you reconsidered. My husband Michael will join us too. If you'd like, I can find a quiet restaurant within 20 minutes of Paramus. I know the area somewhat. Thanks for getting back in touch. I look forward to meeting you. My best, Danny. I had become a master of restraint and understatement. Our lunch was 6 weeks away. I wrote the date, lunch with Ben, in my calendar. It gave me a jolt each time I noticed it, a stark, otherwise blank page amid all the others. Brattleboro Festival, reading at Southampton College, haircut, teaching at Kripalu, dinner with the Campbells, Jacob PSATs, lunch with Ben. The 6 weeks leading up to our meeting were all preamble. I could think of little else. Each time I wrote Ben, I read Michael the email before I sent it. What if he got cold feet again? What if he changed his mind? What if he became ill? Our delicate back and forth continued, though the tone of his emails was markedly warmer. Something had fallen away from him, a tremulous, suspicious sense of me as other. He easily shared personal details. He wasn't really familiar with New Jersey, though he had worked in Trenton the summer before medical school. He preferred Italian food to Greek. He was feeling very well, thank you, other than the usual aches and pains of aging. He sent me his mobile number in case we needed to text each other on the day. And then he wrote, two brief lines that for the first time made me weep. Strange how I misspelled thoughts as thought us. Perhaps it was an appropriate slip. Chapter 38. What do we inherit, and how, and why? The relatively new field of epigenetics studies the impact of environment and experience on genes themselves. How much had the gene pool of the Waldens, that apparently cheerful extended family I had seen singing on YouTube, formed me? I did not come from the line of small, wiry, dark-eyed people of the shtetl, the men swaying over crumbling tombstones, prayer books in their hands. The imprint of pogroms, of the difficulties and sorrows of immigrant life, was not mine, at least not in a physical sense. But I had carried these things a long way in my heart. I was of that dusty and doomed Polish village, and I was not. What had I inherited psychologically? What was in my blood? I was made of three people, my mother, my father, Ben Walden. Disparate worlds had been floating and colliding within me all my life. To contend with these invisible floating worlds, I had created a narrative edifice I now understood. Story after story kept me from ever inching too close to the truth. People had told me every single day of my life that I didn't look like I belonged in my family, nor did I feel I belonged in my family. Yet I didn't stop to consider what this might mean. I couldn't afford to, not even after I learned the method of my conception at the age of 25, not even after Susie told me I ought to look into it. The clues screamed in neon, but I could not see them. After all, plenty of people feel or look other than their parents or siblings. Biology doesn't promise similarity. Traits skip generations. Characteristics emerge seemingly out of nowhere. Our parents seem alien to us. My mother certainly had always seemed alien to me, biology be damned. And so I built my narrative edifice brick by brick. My mother was a pathological narcissist who had a borderline personality disorder. My father was depressed, shattered by marital misfortune. I was an Orthodox Jewish girl who looked like she could have gotten bread from the Nazis. I was the hard-won only child of my older parents. My sense of otherness derived from these, and only these, facts. Ben Walden looked at his own simple typo and saw a Freudian slip, potential meaning. He didn't have second thoughts, but second thoughts about us, he and I, thought us. I had noticed the typo, too, of course, and had smiled at it. It had the kind of psychological nuance I tend to enjoy, the feeling I would have again and again of recognizing myself in Ben, was one I could become aware of only as I realized I had never experienced it before. I had not seen myself in my father, nor had I seen myself reflected back in my mother, no matter that she had given birth to me. Nor had I felt a kinship with Susie, as much as I tried. A friend who had once met Susie later told me that she had always known we couldn't possibly be related. It wasn't only a physical thing. It was a disjunction of the spirit. We didn't fit. We didn't, any of us, belong together. As the weeks ticked closer toward my meeting with Ben, I wondered if he, too, felt this strange sense of familiarity. How much of my work had he read? My books and essays would have given him a smattering of insights and clues. But I had a powerful instinct about him, the kind that doesn't come from study. His gentleness, his manner, his way of being signaled something deeper. I tried to read as much as I could about what it must have been like to have been him, a medical student, a sperm donor, in the early 1960s. I wanted to put myself in his place. He had walked through the doors of that institute in Philadelphia with its cages of albino rats. He had been there, quite often, by his own admission. I couldn't see talking with him about it, and yet I couldn't see not talking with him about it. I found images of the 9-story Art Deco building on the corner of South 36th Street, central to Penn's campus, which now houses the women's clothing store, Loft. The Farris Institute had been on the 6th floor. I thought of my parents, side by side in the elevator, riding up, and of Ben Walden, stepping into the same elevator moments later. The research continued to be bizarre and almost unbearable. I discovered an obituary of Edmund Farris that made no sense. He had died suddenly of a heart attack several months before I was conceived. If Farris was dead, then who was running his institute? A man I met on Wendy Kramer's donor sibling registry told me that Augusta Farris, not a doctor, not a scientist, in fact, a cookbook illustrator, had put on a white lab coat and continued her husband's work after his unexpected death. Did I owe my existence to Augusta Farris? This new information left me reeling. What potent combination of lawlessness, secrecy, desire, shame, greed, and confusion had led to my conception? Would Ben Walden have known anything about the inner workings of Farris, or had he simply slipped through the back door, performed his services, then headed blithely back to chemistry lab? A hardcover book arrived in the mail during that mystifying month of Elul, one I had ordered from a used bookstore online months earlier. It was titled, simply, Artificial Insemination. Its spine cracked when I opened it, emitting the musty scent of old abandoned paper. The book was nearly as old as I was. Its author, Dr. Wilfred Feingold, had been the head of the Department of Sterility at Planned Parenthood in Pittsburgh. Leafing through chapters like Artificial Insemination and Animal Husbandry and Anticipated Legal Problems, I turned to one called The Couple, The Donor. Feingold offered a list of standards all vigilant sterologists and presumably a widowed cookbook illustrator in a white lab coat should follow in order to select donors who would produce the highest quality semen for their patients. 1. The donor must remain an unknown. 2. The donor should be in fine health mentally and physically. 3. The donor should be of fine physical stock. 4. The donor should be of high fertility. 5. The donor should be of excellent character. 6. The donor must be cooperative. 7. The donor's characteristics must match those of the patient's husband. 8. The donors should be men of science or medicine. 9. Multiple donors should be utilized, if possible. The chapter concludes, "It isn't absurd to presume that a child of artificial insemination has an advantage eugenically, mentally, and physically. The donors chosen are devoid of hereditary taints. They have the mental capacity to advance to upper classes in schools of medicine. They are physically able to procreate, and they are even free of such irritating conditions as hay fever or allergy." Chapter 39. My shoulder had begun to ache over the summer, and by early autumn I could hardly move it. It became impossible to reach for a dish on a high shelf or even strap on my seatbelt. If the body can be seen as a metaphor, then it seemed I was shouldering something, carrying a giant boulder on my back all through the night in my sleep, then awakening to a half-frozen self. Nothing helped. Not physical therapy, not yoga, not even a cortisone shot. Days before lunch with Ben, I got the name of an acupuncturist in the Berkshires, an hour's drive from my house. I hoped that he might help release me from whatever had me in its grip. Driving was good. Driving was a moving meditation for me as I sped along winding country roads trying not to think. Reasoning got me nowhere. I had reread some of my early books in recent weeks and was taken aback again and again at the choices I'd made, the language I'd used, particularly in my fiction, that pointed to some sort of consciousness lurking just beyond my ability to perceive it. The truth had been inside me all along. In my first highly autobiographical novel, the narrator is aware that she is out of place in her father's Orthodox Jewish family and longs to be a part of them, but she is haunted by the fact that no one ever recognizes her as part of the family by her face. In a much later novel, a secret wears away at a family until it is very nearly destroyed. Parents, with the best of intentions, make selfish decisions affecting the fate of their child. What had I known without knowing? My unconscious mind had shaped stories out of its own rough landscape. I had scrambled from one rocky path to the next. I had spent all my life writing my way through darkness like a miner in a cave, until I spit into a plastic vial and the lights blinked on. After the acupuncturist took a long history, and I haltingly answered the question of whether my father was living or dead, he asked me to lie face up on a narrow table. He placed needles along the tops of my shoulders, the insides of my wrists, my calves, ankles, and at the center of my sternum. He covered me lightly with a blanket and started to leave me alone in the small room. But before he did, he stopped. "Do you know the three great spiritual questions?" he asked. My eyes were closed, stinging from my disclosure, as they often did. "Who am I?" I whispered and paused. I couldn't remember the other two. We were silent for a long moment. Outside his office, on the main street of Stockbridge, I could hear the whoosh of a passing car, the chirp of a lone bird. Finally, he continued, "Why am I here?" Tears ran down my temples and into my hair. He paused before offering me the last question. "And how shall I live?" I lay on that table for what seemed like hours. Hanging on the wall next to me were several Eastern medicine diagrams of the human body. They looked like intricate topographical maps with well over 300 individual points lining the main meridians. Lungs, large intestine, stomach, spleen, heart, small intestine, bladder, kidneys, pericardium, gallbladder, liver. Fine lines and arrows dipped and swirled in elaborate patterns and channels that I found at once disconcerting and comforting. How had I lived my life without being able to answer that first and most fundamental of all questions? Who am I? Without an answer, how could I possibly have fully moved on to the others? Why am I here? Augusta Farris in her white lab coat, my parents in all their shame and desire, Ben Walden and his assurances of anonymity. Shirley's words floated back to me. Not an accident of history. This was the challenge that had been set down at my feet. How shall I live? Chapter 40. The streets of Teaneck, New Jersey were nearly deserted on Erev Yom Kippur. We had arrived early and circled the block a couple of times to get our bearings. In the emptiness and quiet, not typical of an ordinary weekday, I could sense the town's anticipation of the holiest day in the Jewish year. We passed a large synagogue, one of several. By this evening, it would be crowded with congregants, and the sound of the shofar would pierce the air. A suburb of New York City, Teaneck has long been known for its tight-knit Jewish population. My father's younger brother raised his family in this town, and I counted at least two cousins among its many rabbis. This only added to the surreal nature of the moment. Of all the possible destinations, this place, to which I felt an uneasy connection, had turned out to be the best meeting spot for lunch with Ben and Pilar. Michael and I parked just outside Amarone, an Italian restaurant I had chosen. I know the area somewhat. In fact, I knew the area not at all, and had relied on the recommendations of local friends, one of whom had even scouted a couple of places and sent me photographs. Much of my anxiety had been poured into making a restaurant choice. It needed to be quiet, but not too quiet. Not empty at the lunch hour, or too busy. I didn't want us to feel rushed. Oh, and not too expensive, but nice enough to be relaxing. I then called the restaurant and asked for a corner table. My friend had specified which one, and explained that it was a special occasion. No, not a birthday or an anniversary, nothing like that. Just important. I was in a state of high alert. Even after all the careful planning, it seemed crazy and impossible, as if I had been swept into someone's novel, someone's melodramatic novel, and I was playing a character rather than living my life. And then there were the practical concerns. Was I going to risk alienating him by asking questions about what he remembered from that time? Were we going to keep it at polite chit-chat? How much would we share with each other? And what about his wife? I wondered what it could possibly be like, married for 50 years, retired with 3 grown children, to discover that your husband had another child. From what I could gather about Pilar from bits and pieces available online, she seemed to have lived a traditional life for a woman of her generation. She was a doctor's wife, an avid golfer. She and Ben were dedicated congregants of a local church. My news must have rocked their world, and yet they had come around to deciding to have this meeting. Second thought us. "We should go in," Michael said. We still had half an hour. Maybe they had arrived early as well. What if they were already inside? I wanted to stay suspended in this moment of before. I didn't have the muscles for this. How could I be emotionally or psychologically equipped to meet the biological father I hadn't ever known existed? It was as if I had just strapped on my ice skates and was expected to perform a triple axel. "I'm not ready." We sat in the car, watching the entrance of Amarone. The restaurant's maroon canopy hung over a small patio dotted with tables. It was still quite warm, unseasonably so. I had worn a favorite sweater over a silk camisole and corduroy jeans for my meeting with my biological father. "Father," Michael had said that morning as he was getting dressed, "we've been married 20 years and I'm about to meet your father." I had considered wearing something of my dad's to keep him close to me, but I didn't want him at the table with Ben. I didn't want him hovering there, stricken, sorrowful. It felt like a betrayal of one father that I was meeting my other father. And if my dad had known, had always loved me, as I knew he did, in full recognition that I wasn't his biological child, then that too would make this day fraught beyond measure. If he had chosen to keep such a massive secret, how could it feel to have that secret revealed now, when it was too late to discuss or make amends? I once heard a psychic say that the dead are able to observe the living with compassion but not emotion. In that case, the entire restaurant would be filled with my long-lost relatives, mother, father, aunts, uncles, floating, invisible, impassively witnessing the meeting about to take place. I watched the sidewalk and front door of Amarone. "Let's go in," Michael said again. "I can't." I felt pinned to the spot. How do I greet him? Do I hug him? Shake his hand? "You'll know." "And who should pick up the check?" "We'll pick up the check." "You don't think that will insult him?" "Honey, you're going to have to let this play out." Just then, seeing before I fully registered what I was seeing, I caught a glimpse of an older couple slowly walking up the sidewalk in the near distance. The man was tall, white-haired, wearing a blue button-down shirt and khakis. He held the bent elbow of a petite, elegant woman. It was Ben. "Get out of the car," Michael said. "I can't. Let's wait." "Get out of the car," he repeated. "Now." He said it lovingly, but firmly, not taking no for an answer, as if teaching a child to swim or ride a bike. This was my moment to flail or to fall on my own. I opened the car door. I saw them seeing me. There was no going back. The four of us moved toward one another. It was probably no more than half a dozen steps. What now? There seemed to be nothing to do but acknowledge the strangeness, to live inside the world of it. "Ben," I said. "Hello." It was bewildering to look at him, to see my features reflected back at me. All those staring contests I'd held with myself as a child were about this, I now understood. I had been searching and searching for the truth in the mirror, trying to make sense of my own face. Here it was, finally, irrefutably, in the form of the old man standing before me. I stuck out my hand. "I'm Danny." His eyes crinkled as he smiled. Both of us were flushed, bright pink. Michael and Pilar were now both standing slightly apart from us. A passerby might take us for a family. Ben took an awkward half-step toward me. His voice was like a fragment from a remembered dream. His first words, "Would it be all right to give you a hug?" Chapter 41. We were seated, as I had requested, at a secluded corner table. Checked tablecloth, leather menus, Italian bread, a small pitcher of olive oil. Our water glasses filled and filled again. We didn't touch our menus for at least the first hour. Beneath the table, I couldn't stop shaking. I had no appetite. I directed most of my conversation to Pilar, but my ears were trained on Ben's conversation with Michael. They were talking of simple things, ordinary things. Both men had been in the Peace Corps. They had done some research on each other. They knew they had that in common. Ben and Pilar had read three of my books and were in the middle of a book Michael had written about foreign aid. We had all boned up, as if for an important exam. But there was something I had promised myself I would say, and I said it as soon as I had an opening to cut through the polite chit-chat. "I want to thank you," I addressed Ben. "You didn't have to do this. When I first wrote you, you could have ignored it." His cheeks became even redder. "He deleted it from his mailbox the second he read it," Pilar said. She had a lilting voice and retained her Brazilian accent. "Like a hot potato." Those interminable, surreal days in San Francisco, checking my email, obsessively checking, envisioning the doctor in Portland opening my letter. He had deleted it. He had hoped it would just go away. "Then you wrote me again," Ben said, and I fished it out of my trash. "I was shocked," Pilar's voice rose. "It will be months before I know what she really said to Ben. How could you have been so stupid?" "It just never occurred to me that I might have biological children out there," he said. "I donated for a short while. I honestly never thought about it after I finished medical school." Michael and I exchanged a quick glance. It seemed purposeful, Ben's phrase. He was letting us know that he hadn't been prolific, that I was not in a situation, like some I had read about, where I might have hundreds of half-siblings, which of course was the very scenario about which he and Pilar must have been most terrified. "In time, I will question how it could be possible that Ben, a man of medicine who specialized in medical ethics, had never considered that he might have biological children. I will think of the three of them, my mother, my father, Ben Walden, all burying the consequences of their actions so deep that it seemed there weren't any consequences at all. But not on this day. On this day, my entire being was trying to absorb as much as possible. Who knew if we would ever be together again?" As we finally ordered lunch, caprese salad, grilled chicken, we went over the whole story detail by detail. The way Michael zeroed in on the Farris Institute, our hunch about the donor being a medical student at Penn, the appearance of Adam Thomas on my ancestry page, the ease with which we found him, Ben's nephew, my first cousin, on Facebook, Ben's sister's obituary. In the absence of A.T., we would not have been gathered at that table. The elderly doctor from Portland and I would have remained oblivious and anonymous to one another. I would have discovered that I wasn't my dad's biological daughter, but known nothing more. I might have spent the rest of my life looking into the faces of certain men, wondering how I came to be. Pilar was telling me about her golf game, their lives in a retirement community near Portland, and stories of their three children, but I continued to have one ear tuned in to Ben and Michael's conversation. I heard Ben ask if Michael had seen a photo of his daughter Emily. I could feel Ben's gaze upon me, his astonishment at the resemblance. Every cell in my body was on high alert. I had questions for him I felt I couldn't ask. I didn't dare upset the delicate balance. We were four people who genuinely liked one another. We had entire conversations in which the reason for being together seemed to be momentarily forgotten, that is, except by me. I kept looking over at Ben, and then away. Father. He didn't feel like my father. He hadn't raised me. We'd met hours earlier. So who was he to me, and I to him? Biological. Social. Later, it will occur to me that Ben Walden felt to me like my native country. I had never lived in this country. I had never spoken its language or become steeped in its customs. I had no passport or record of citizenship. Still, I had been shaped by my country of origin all my life, suffused with an inchoate longing to know my own land. The sunlight that had streamed through the restaurant's windows had now vanished. 4.5 hours had passed in a moment. The other diners had long since vacated their tables. The waitstaff was setting up the restaurant for dinner all around us. Dusk would soon fall. My relatives would be preparing for Yuntif. Pilar asked to see a photo of Jacob, and I scrolled through albums on my phone for the one I had planned to show them if asked. It had been taken over the summer. Jacob's hair was bleached by the sun, and he was tanned from months outside, shooting films and playing tennis. He looked like a golden boy. He looked quite a bit like Ben. Pilar inhaled sharply when she saw him. So handsome. Then she passed my phone to Ben. At some point, Ben seemed to have made a decision to trust me, to put aside his concerns about privacy or my being a writer or worries about possible other offspring. Perhaps this had happened before we even met. The week prior, on Rosh Hashanah, he had sent me a note wishing us Lashana Tova Tikatevu, may you be inscribed in the Book of Life for a good year. He must have looked it up. He was reaching out a hand, respecting our differences while understanding the enormity of our bond. After he studied the photo of Jacob for a good long minute, Ben picked up his own phone and handed it to me. It was open to a folder of photographs. He cleared his throat. I put these together, thinking I might show them to you, he said. Ancestors. Family. A man and woman stood on the porch of a farmhouse. She wore a flowered dress. He was in shirt sleeves. I once again had the sensation of not being able to compute what I was looking at. My parents, said Ben, at home in Ohio. Grandparents. Not the imposing bald man with the yarmulke and pince-nez. Not the regal woman in the gilded frame, hair pulled tightly back, a brooch at her throat. Those were the grandparents of my psyche, but not of my being. I was descended from this couple. I searched their faces as if I might find something familiar there. And the next one is my grandfather, Ben said. He was a lawyer in Cleveland. A photograph of a mustached man, self-conscious and unsmiling in the manner of the day. And his father, my great-grandfather, a sepia portrait from the mid-19th century. Our family landed on Nantucket in the 1600s. In neighborhoods all around us, families would have completed the Yuntif meal before the customary fast and have started the walk to shul, leaving yahrzeit candles to burn on kitchen counters, remembering their dead. Just outside this Italian restaurant, I could picture men in their tallises, women with their heads covered, small boys wearing small yarmulkes, girls in dresses holding their father's hands, parading down the streets, as I once did. In synagogues, Torahs rested in their arks, dressed in embroidered velvet and gleaming silver. When three stars appeared in the darkening sky, arks would be opened and all would rise. The Kol Nidre service would commence in all its plaintive beauty. Landed on Nantucket in the 1600s. It made no sense and all kinds of sense. But before I had even a moment to digest it, Michael's phone began vibrating on the table. As he picked it up, I saw that it was Jacob. He knew we had been meeting with Ben and Pilar, and surely figured lunch must be over. I panicked. Go take it outside, I urged Michael. I didn't want Ben to feel pressed or railroaded. The sense of the fragility of our bond returned full force. As Michael began to rise, Ben stopped him. It's okay, he said gently. It's fine. Michael handed me the phone. Our boy's face filled the screen. We're still with Ben and Pilar, honey, I said. Do you want to say hello? I turned the phone's screen to Ben. He took it from me and looked at his grandson. Hi, Jacob. How are you doing? It's very nice to meet you. I'm good. It's great to meet you, too. In the architecture of extraordinary moments that had begun the previous June, so many instances that were singular, inexplicable, beautiful, and deeply mysterious. Watching a 78-year-old man meet his 17-year-old grandson on FaceTime felt sacred. Something loose within me settled. If nothing else happened, if we never saw one another again, Jacob and his grandfather had acknowledged each other, as if to simply say, "There you are." None of us wanted to part. After we made our way out of the restaurant and onto the street, we walked Ben and Pilar to their car, which was parked across from the synagogue around the corner. "You know, Emily is interested in knowing you," Pilar said. "I'm interested in knowing her as well," I answered. "You should write to her," Pilar said. I didn't know if it was okay. I thought of Emily's smoke signal to me via Twitter. "I see you." And mine back to her. "I see you too." What would it mean to get to know my half-sister? "I'm sure I'm going to hear from her tonight, asking how our lunch went," Pilar said with a twinkle in her eye. "What do you think I should tell her?" "Tell her it couldn't have gone better." In our remaining moments, I let Ben and Pilar know that I would be in Portland during my book tour the following spring. This seemed to be a relief to all of us, the idea that we'd be able to get together again. "We'll come to your reading," Ben said. And then we hugged goodbye. Each one of us hugged the others, and this time there was no awkwardness, only a sense of having been visited by some kind of grace. When Michael and I arrived back home later that evening, I looked through my cupboards for my usual stock of Yahrzeit candles, but it turned out we had none. I would light no candles in memory of my complicated, beloved, dead parents on the night that I met Ben Walden. Instead, I tried to hold all of them in my overflowing heart. Later, a rabbi will remind me that the Hebrew word for father, Abba, is composed of the first two letters in the alphabet, Aleph Bet. He will ask me if I can accept the two tributaries, these two fathers I come from. I will learn to accept the two tributaries, in time. Their convergence is the story of my life. But on that night, I sat alone on the chaise in my office, the same chaise where less than 4 months earlier I had discovered the truth of my paternity, and I wrote Ben a note of thanks. I signed this one, "With love." Part 4. Chapter 42. I would have thought, in the aftermath of my lunch with Ben, that I would have felt somehow better, relieved perhaps, consoled by the loveliness of the encounter. After all, it was just about the best possible outcome for a donor-conceived person. I found myself describing it as miraculous, which I believed it was, but it was not only miraculous. I was in a deeper despair that surprised me. Sensitive to bright light, startled by the most harmless noise, a clanging pipe, a slammed door would make me jump. I continued to spend most days in my house, burrowing into the history of donor insemination, reading academic papers quoting ethicists and philosophers on the rights of donor-conceived children, and further books on halacha, as if I might find a single key that would unlock a door leading to everything I still didn't know. Sometimes, late at night, exhausted, emotionally spent, I would end up on websites displaying catalogs of sperm donors. I scrolled through page after page. These men used handles like Le Artist, 100-Watt Smile, McDonor, Coach of the Year, and Mission Accomplished. While on these websites, I would feel faintly uncomfortable, voyeuristic, as if I had gone to a place where I didn't belong. If asked, I wouldn't have been able to articulate what I was looking for, why I was perusing catalogs of sperm donors. The biblical story of Joseph and his brothers came flooding back to me, along with a passage from Thomas Mann's novel of the same name. His desire to set a new beginning to the chain of events to which he belonged encountered the same difficulty that it always does. The fact that everybody has a father, that nothing comes first and of itself, its own cause, but that everybody is begotten and points backwards, deeper down into the depths of beginnings, the bottoms and abysses of the well of the past. We came from different worlds, Ben and I, and we had lived different lives, unshared lives. But everyone has a father, and he was mine. He begat me, to use the ancient language, and therefore a connection existed between us so powerful it felt impossible to grasp. As I scanned the biographical information of these men, I wondered if they understood, really understood, what they were doing. I clicked on some of their profiles. All were described as handsome and bearing similarity to celebrities ranging from Kurt Cobain to Cary Grant. And many were listed as anonymous. Anonymous, anonymous, anonymous. They were not willing to be contacted when the child turned 18. They wished to donate and be done with it. Could a man donate sperm, check the anonymous box, and, emotionally speaking, be done with it? Or, as Ben had done many decades earlier, perhaps such a thing could be compartmentalized. Well over a decade earlier, Michael and I had tried to expand our own family. We hadn't wanted Jacob to be an only child, but his illness as a baby had consumed us for some years, and we had waited until we were certain he was going to be okay. By then, I was in my 40s. Months of trying led to relatively low-tech intrauterine inseminations. Michael experienced his own version of a cubicle with its assortment of porn. I had one miscarriage, then a second one, this time at the end of my first trimester. We gripped hands in my obstetrician's office as we were told that the heartbeat was faint. Then, a week later, gone. I clutched my belly and wept, as the possibility that we could have a second baby of our own dwindled to nothing. Jacob was, by this point, 6 years old. The age difference between him and a possible sibling was growing wider with each passing month. Nights, Michael and I sat side by side on the sofa in our library, leafing through photos and brief biographies of young women, egg donors, in an attempt to replace or even improve upon my aging, faulty biology. We looked at Jewish donors, athletic donors, Ivy-educated donors, former model donors. We pored over handwriting, dismissing certain young women for ridiculous reasons. One dotted her I's with hearts. Another had gone to an evangelical university. What did that have to do with their genes? Our obsession and confusion grew in equal measures. Without knowing it or sensing it, we slipped into the gray, murky world that my parents had once lived in, an atmosphere in which we felt shame, failure, pain, and were offered a sliver of hope. Even at the time, I thought of us as putting blinders on, eyes on the prize. I knew that if we stopped to ponder all of the possible implications of our actions, we would grind to a halt. We did know one thing for sure, so obvious to us that we barely had need to discuss it. This baby, if there was to be a baby, would always know her origin. It would be woven into her earliest life like a bright thread with no fanfare. We knew plenty of parents of donor-conceived kids who had beautiful families. Some had told their children, and others hadn't. I felt uncomfortable around the kids who weren't aware of their true identities. How was it possible that I knew something so fundamental about them that they didn't know themselves? How could the parents believe this was for the best? I couldn't imagine, so I told myself, going through life carrying such a secret. But of course, I had been just like those kids, and my parents like their parents. The problem, it now seemed to me, was anonymity, the promise of it, the desire for it. The hidden disaster was secrecy, the pretense and magical thinking, the certainty that no one ever needed to know. It wasn't that my parents had sought to conceive a baby in this manner, unorthodox and lawless as it once was, but that they had banished the truth even from themselves, thereby obscuring it from me. I'd begun to understand how it might have happened. Still, their choices had formed my inner world as a place of cracks and fissures, lacunae of a lost child who intuited her own otherness and blamed herself for it. I understood that otherness now. I had just had lunch with it. Secrecy and anonymity had been the prevailing wisdom 50, 60 years ago. But now? As I opened website after website, I wondered how many children were still being born into a lie. Donors continued to stay in the shadows, or at least many of them planned to. Of course, in today's world, the very idea that anonymity could be guaranteed was ludicrous. But there it was, again and again. I recalled Alan Duchernay's rueful words, "Now there are no more secrets." I decided to pay a visit to the California Cryobank, America's largest sperm bank. I wanted to witness the contemporary landscape of assisted reproduction, not as the frightened, clueless consumer I had been years earlier, but as a person who possessed the long secret information about her own origins. On a classic Los Angeles late afternoon, the sky cloudless, palm trees rustling in the slightest breeze, I craned my neck skyward, staring at a 6,000-gallon stainless steel silo towering over a two-story building in a residential neighborhood. It was filled with vials of sperm frozen in liquid nitrogen, surrounded by barbed wire and a sophisticated alarm system. It felt as if I were staring at the future, as if encased in that silo were the eventual populations of several small countries. Beside me was the California Cryobank's founder, Cappy Rothman, a spry 80-year-old urologist known as the God of Sperm. Rothman had slicked back long white hair and piercing blue eyes. He had come on the reproductive medicine scene well after the time of my conception, so he wouldn't be likely to have information or background for me. His interest wasn't in the history I was working so hard to understand, but in the future. I was curious about the future, too, struck hard by the many stories I'd read and heard from men and women who felt exiled from their own identities, set apart by a lack of information. "How many souls, potential souls, do you have here?" I asked as I tried to take in a campus that looked like a small, well-protected nuclear arsenal. I used the term soul purposefully. I wanted to sort out whether Rothman thought of the lives that would be potentiated by these vials of sperm, or whether his interest stopped at the point of purchase. In the Cryobank's catalog, I had noticed that childhood photos could be purchased a la carte, along with a three-generation history, a recording of the donor speaking about his areas of interest, even examples of poetry, songs, essays, and drawings. Parents, and perhaps children, would be able to listen to the sound of a donor's voice or read a handwritten sonnet. I wondered whether such biographical bits and pieces would ever be enough. Rothman paused, as if he had never considered the question. There were hundreds of cylinders, and each, as I saw when we entered the interior and Rothman pried open a few for me, contained thousands upon thousands of tiny vials of sperm bobbing in the vapor. "Millions, I guess," he said. "Millions of souls." It was a far cry from the small secretive world my parents had encountered in Philadelphia in 1961. The technology to freeze sperm did not yet exist. Of course they'd had no catalog, no websites advertising dreams and possibilities, or examples of their potential donor's dream lunch date, as if this were a Proust questionnaire. Did my parents sit in Edmund Farris's office debating the merits of certain men? I truly didn't think so. The decorous, polite euphemisms of the day would have sufficed. Would an attempt have been made to match my dad's coloring? Would they have paid attention to blood type? Unlike many prospective parents of today, us included, my parents would not have wished for the curriculum vitae of their donor. They would have wanted to block him out, to explode him into bits and particles that left only a microscopic trace. "Leave it to us," my parents may have been told. That is, if they were clearly told anything at all. In Rothman's second floor office, we sat surrounded by replicas of famous paintings. Van Gogh's The Starry Night was hung next to one of his self-portraits, all made up of swirls of swimming sperm. Later, Rothman will send me Sperm Bank swag, a ballpoint pen displaying a tiny floating plastic embryo, a t-shirt printed with a version of Edvard Munch's The Scream, with a sperm who looked a bit like Casper the Friendly Ghost. It was difficult to tell whether his campy self-presentation was a kind of performance art, or his holy grail, or perhaps a bit of both. He had fashioned himself as a creator of life. The more life, the better. I started to tell Rothman about my own recent discovery. It was hard to keep his attention, but eventually I did manage to stutter out the story. He looked distressed when I got to the part about finding Ben. Unsurprisingly, he and many other directors of sperm banks believe that doing away with anonymity would destroy the industry. And this may be true. If Ben had known, as a young medical student, that his identity might someday be found out, he would never have done it. I would not exist. What about disclosure? I asked him. Do you counsel parents to tell their children about their origins? He shrugged. That's up to them, really. We don't get involved. I don't see what difference it makes. It can be very traumatic, I said, to not know, and then to find out. I was starting to get emotional. All those metal cylinders containing tiny vials, each vial filled with a staggering number of frozen sperm. When we had walked through the facility earlier, I had noticed shipping containers with metal canisters filled with liquid nitrogen, capped with bright yellow stickers. Do not return empty vials. The frozen sperm of donors like La Artist and Coach of the Year were carefully packed into reinforced corrugated cardboard and loaded onto FedEx trucks or into the cargo holds of airplanes, heading God knows where. Millions, millions of souls. Why is it traumatic? Rothman looked puzzled. You're here, aren't you? I had heard this logic before. Would I have preferred not to have been born? Of course not. I was grateful for my life. Grateful that Ben Walden had a free hour on the day of my conception. Grateful for the potent combination of my parents' courage and despair, even for their capacity to put those blinders on. But gratitude and trauma weren't mutually exclusive. I spoke slowly. It's traumatic because I'm 54 years old, and I found out that the father I adored, the father who raised me, was not my biological father. That the family I thought I came from is not my biological family. That my ancestors are not my biological ancestors. Rothman sat back in his chair and assessed me. A look of genuine compassion flitted across his face. I can see how that would be difficult, he said. And then he brightened. But you look fantastic for 54, he said. You got good genes. The intrauterine inseminations, the hormones, the catalogs of shiny young women that Michael and I had perused, the meetings with doctors, therapists, professionals, more than one cross-country trip, all took place in an increasingly frantic blur. Each step led us deeper and deeper down a rabbit hole in which the moves were choreographed to appear logical and sane. And they were logical for many people, but not for us. I sleepwalked through that time as if some buried part of me knew that I was in familiar territory. History on repeat. What vestiges, scraps of dialogue, exchanged glances, closed doors, harsh whispers clung to me over the years, had me feeling, as we tried for a second child, as a child became a goal, as if I had stepped into the rehearsal of a play whose lines I already knew by heart. We walked away in the end. We decided that our little family of three was exactly the right number for us, that Jacob's life as an only child would be happier than mine. It might have been different had we had no children, had we been determined to become parents at any cost. But it was a sense I had that this path was dangerous for me. I didn't understand why, but something told me that we might just be ruining our lives. Misery, heartache, denial, secrets, grief were all tied up in it. All I knew was that I felt suffocated, paralyzed, by choices I couldn't bring myself to make, and a future I couldn't fathom. I wasn't thinking about our own brief, frenzied foray into the realm of assisted reproduction on the day I discovered my father wasn't my father, nor when I first recalled my mother's precise words on the Sawmill River Parkway, followed by Susie's suggestion that I delve deeper. I, at first, drew no parallels between my parents' experience and my own when I realized I was donor-conceived and the tumblers all spun open and I found Ben. It is a measure of true adulthood that we are able to imagine our parents as the people they may have been before us. My mother, not yet the full-blown narcissist borderline with the raging temper. My father, not yet the fragile man consumed by his own sorrow. But the two of them, young, vibrant, still in love with each other, wishing, hoping, praying for a life that would offer them a family, recompense for their struggles. As time went on and my shock began to dissipate, I was able to reach back into the world before me and picture them, flawed, optimistic, subscribing to the theories of the day, giving themselves over to the perceived wisdom of others. Not long after I met Ben, I found an unopened box of my mother's buried in our basement, containing notes and cards from my birth. Among them, a telegram from a rabbi in Israel, addressed to my grandparents, congratulating them on the great mitzvah of the arrival of their 10th grandchild. At the very bottom of the box was a small florist's card written to my mother in my father's hand. "Dearest darling, it's been long, it's been hard, but like you always do, extra special. All my love, Paul." Chapter 43. One day, while cleaning out my desk drawers, I found a card Susie had written to Jacob on his bar mitzvah 4 years earlier. "Redeemable for the portrait of your great-grandfather Joseph Shapiro," the card read. Susie had inherited the portrait of our grandfather when Shirley moved to Chicago. It had been a sore point for me, though I had never said so. That portrait of our grandfather had hung over the fireplace in my grandparents' apartment. In a family that prided itself on its portraits, this was the definitive portrait of the family patriarch, large, painterly, formidable. Our grandfather was stately in a dark gray three-piece suit, a hand resting on a book, his pince-nez balanced on the bridge of his nose. He looked like a man in control of his destiny. I held some sort of magical belief that being in possession of his portrait would mean I was also in control of mine. I had wondered why Shirley had given the portrait to Susie, and was secretly pleased and surprised that Susie planned to bequeath it to Jacob. I hoped Jacob would hang it in a future home, an heirloom, a relic of his heritage. But would the portrait still be redeemable now that Joseph Shapiro was no longer Jacob's great-grandfather? The question was at once piercing and irrelevant. I knew Jacob would have no interest, might never have had any interest, in this long-dead man, whether or not he was related to him. Regardless, it was still stunning that part of our lives was over, sealed like a time capsule containing grainy documentary footage, a yellowed talus, silver filigreed talus clips, and framed photographs of the people I had once believed were ours. Susie had fallen away from me again with astonishing ease, in fact with something like relief. Our lifetime of disconnection finally explained. For a brief time after my initial discovery, we had several phone conversations in which we tried to parse out what our father may or may not have known. I asked Susie if she had always suspected I wasn't our father's child. Was that why she'd brought up the practice of confused artificial insemination all those years ago? Indeed, she had suspected, she told me. "Why?" I asked her. "You just looked so Christian," she answered. I turned my attention to my other half-sister, not the distrusting one hovering on the periphery of my childhood, but the one with whom I shared a blood tie. Ben and Pilar had given me permission, something I felt I needed in order to contact her. They had been warm and forthcoming, yet with each passing day, I touched on the sense that part of me would now and forever be a wanderer, a stranger in a strange land. The language of the Torah regularly rose up from a deep place within me as if stirred from the bottom of a giant cauldron. "The Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth." Exile was a theme in which I was well schooled. Banishment and its aftermath were stitched into every biblical story I could think of. Even my Jacob's Torah portion for his own bar mitzvah had been Bamidbar, a dreadfully boring passage in which God asks Moses to conduct a census of the 12 tribes of Israel who wander in the desert. I had begun to call upon friends and acquaintances, rabbis, ministers, Buddhist monks, philosophers, to ask for guidance. I knew these remarkable people because I had written a spiritual memoir when Jacob was a little boy, as a way of reconciling my beliefs, or lack of beliefs, with my religious background. I was in a spiritual crisis at the time, but now it seemed as if I must have known that someday I would need to summon an army. Now I was in a crisis of the soul. If I didn't know how to locate myself, in the roots of my history, in the geography that had formed me. How was I supposed to make sense of the rest of my life? A guru told me, with a certainty I couldn't help but envy, that the dead do not feel pain. When we die, she said, we survey it all, the whole complex human catastrophe we've left behind. We see patterns and designs from the great distance of death, and understand our life's purpose after the fact. An expert in the philosophy of yoga pointed me to a book on karma. The director of a holistic institute promised me that when I got to the other side of my own searing pain, I would be set free. She suggested I stand in front of each portrait of the people I believe to be my ancestors and ask, "Who are you to me?" Just before Hanukkah, I called David Ingber, a rabbi who had become a colleague and a friend. It had been 6 months since my wandering had commenced. After listening to my entire story, he quietly said, "You can say, this is impossible, terrible. Or you can say, this is beautiful, wonderful. You can imagine that you're in exile, or you can imagine that you have more than one home." At the end of our conversation, I wished the rabbi a happy Hanukkah. "Happy Hanukkah," he replied back, and, he laughed, "Merry Christmas." In the spirit of beautiful, wonderful possibilities, I wrote Emily Walden a note on her Facebook page and received an email back from her the following day. Her correspondence felt instantly familiar. How to explain it? Each of us, two women close in age, married a similar length of time, with children who are also close in age, curled up with our morning coffee once a month or so, and wrote letters that grew longer with each exchange. Here's a photo I took on my morning walk. This is the view out my window. Both of us, shy, strong, quiet, loyal, sensitive. Both of us, serious about our work, fierce about our kids, devoted to our long-lasting female friendships. I'm trying to be more intentional of late to reconnect with the important people in my life. I'm home alone, a rare and savory occurrence. I had recently taken an online version of the Myers-Briggs personality test and discovered that I am an INFJ, introverted, intuitive, feeling, judging, a category that makes up less than 1% of the population. I had a feeling that Emily might also fall into that 1%. Which of our qualities could be understood as inherited? What had formed us? She had grown up in Portland, daughter of Ben and Pilar, a physician and his immigrant wife. She was the oldest of three. She had gone to church with her parents every Sunday morning of her childhood. Photos of Emily showed a dark-haired, lanky, pretty little girl, a fresh-faced teenager at camp and on school field trips. Ben was right. We did look a lot alike, despite our very different coloring. On the opposite edge of the country, I had grown up the only child of Paul and Irene, an observant Jewish stockbroker and a former advertising executive turned unhappy homemaker. I had gone to synagogue with my dad every Saturday morning of my life. Similar photos existed of me, a gap-toothed, grinning girl, an awkward high school student wearing a crewneck sweater and corduroys. It was so strange now to contemplate our different worlds, and yet the profound, intimate genetic link of having the same father. Just as I'd thought about Ben, I considered the ways my path might have crossed with Emily's over the years. It seemed Emily and I might easily have friends and experiences in common. In time, we will discover that we have followed the work of the same meditation teacher, and that Emily has friends who have been to Hedgebrook, a women-only writer's retreat in the Pacific Northwest, where I've taught master classes. The degrees of separation between us were few. We may have been in audiences together at literary readings or meditation talks. We might have attended the same parties. Despite our 6-year age difference, we attended graduate school at the same time. Ferries, trains, buses, planes, millions of souls brushing up against one another, knowing nothing. But then there were other ways in which Emily and I were products of our different universes. Those YouTube videos I had watched in the tense weeks waiting to hear whether Ben was willing to meet me depicted a big, boisterous family celebrating Christmas. One Saturday morning, I awoke to a long note from Emily in which she included a photograph she'd taken of a recipe card, stained brown from use. Alice Walden, our biological grandmother, was an amazing woman. She never went to college, as she cared for her ill mother. But she was really bright and articulate. My dad says she used to read the dictionary for fun. I've attached a recipe of hers for you. I stared at the handwriting for a few moments, studying it. Alice Walden, Ben's mother, Emily's grandmother. My grandmother, technically speaking. Was it my imagination, or was there something familiar in the way Alice Walden shaped her letters? Could there be anything genetic to be understood about the way handwriting evolves over generations? It seemed possible. Then I turned my attention to the recipe itself, which was for something called 24-hour lettuce salad. The instructions were to pat a broken-up head of lettuce into the bottom of a casserole dish, preferably a pretty glass one, then add celery, green onions, peppers, and water chestnuts over the lettuce, cover with an entire cup of mayonnaise, sprinkle with sugar, cheese, salad seasoning, and refrigerate for 24 hours, adding bacon bits just before serving. If I had been tasked to invent the most Goyesha recipe imaginable, I don't think I could have come up with anything to improve upon it. The cheese and bacon bits, mixing dairy with meat, bacon no less, were about as treif as a meal could get in the Yiddish idiom of my childhood. Not to mention the very idea of a salad casserole, refrigerated overnight. While the Waldens were dining on their grandmother's 24-hour lettuce salad, in the home of my childhood, we were eating chicken soup with matzo balls, meat-filled kreplach, gefilte fish topped with bright red horseradish sauce. Emily's hymns, my Shabbos prayers, her Christmas tree and tinsel and caroling, my family's silver menorah, the one I use to this day, candles blazing each Hanukkah in the bay window of my childhood home. The large, contented, peopled world in which she was raised. The small, confusing, solitary world that I escaped from. Her father, our father, yet in so many ways not my father, with his pink cheeks and thoughtful, kind demeanor. My father, the one whose voice I will hear for the rest of my life, singing the Birkat HaMazon, the grace after meals. If I close my eyes now,